Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to the A24 project here on the Nerd Party Network. Dallas King and myself make our way through the A24 back catalogue, and along the way we interview the talent involved in front of and behind the camera. In this episode, I'm joined by critic and writer Douglas Lamon to discuss and explain A24's many streaming deals. Douglas, welcome to the podcast.
It's an honor to be here. Thank you so much.
For those that are tuning in, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Hello, my name is Douglas Lamon. I'm a film writer located somewhere on the autism spectrum and in Texas. I've got a passion for all things in the world of movies, every genre, country, style, under the sun. In addition to my writing work, I'm about to finish my last semester of graduate school at the University of Texas at Dallas, and I hope to parlay that degree to teaching. Fingers crossed.
So I suppose my question for everyone that comes on is sort of, are you a fan of the A24 filmography, and are there any sort of highlights for you, Douglas?
Oh, I'm very much so. I remember A24 started like releasing stuff in my last year of high school, and I remember distinctly thinking, like, there's something unique about these guys who are doing like a James Franco Spring Break movie and The Spectacular Now. They're definitely a little off the beaten path.
You kind of recently have written a really excellent piece for Collider, sort of about A24's streaming deals with DirecTV, Apple TV. Where did your interest in this subject come from? Because it's something we've spoken about a little bit on the podcast, that sometimes there's what we call the DirecTV A24 movie, and, you know, kind of almost when we started this podcast, the Apple TV deal had been announced. So it's always been something that's been on in the background, but we've never sort of discussed it as a topic. So what inspired you to write this excellent piece?
Always been interested in movie studios. Even when I was a kid, I find something compelling about what motivates the existence and financing of the art I love. Because, like, if you don't understand that, then you don't understand, like, where the stuff we love comes from. And as a newer film studio, A24 has been especially interesting because they don't have a large back catalog to lean on. It always feels like they're coming up with new ways to keep going, you know? Like, that's just what indie studios do. This particular idea just came about because I was thinking about Macbeth. And I realized, like, how parallel, like, similar, they've always had these deals. For some reason, it finally clicked on me, like, they've had a lot of different deals with different streaming services over the years. And it immediately became like, okay, I gotta write about this. This is just too many interests intersecting at once not to do it.
And what's been the reaction to that article? We always think of these things sometimes as being very niche, but sometimes that brings out quite a lot of people.
It hasn't been, like, something that's, I would say, transcends into, like, everybody's, I know, talked about it, but people that I know that are already fans of this subject matter have definitely been interested in it. And it was definitely interesting to, like, see that it got a decent amount of page views and that there's a little more. Writing is sort of an insular activity, sometimes, like, just being alone in a room. So it's interesting to get reminded of, oh, there's other people with these interests. There's other people that are, like, curious about this stuff. So it's good to get that kind of feedback.
Let's kind of go to the start almost of these A24 deals. Can you kind of explain sort of what the DirecTV deal was, and sort of to explain to maybe sort of our non-American audiences what DirecTV is?
Sure. So DirecTV is a programming provider in the United States of America, mainly specializes in satellite television. In the early 2010s, they were trying to expand their reach in pop culture. And part of that was coming up with a deal with A24, wherein the studios would work together on releasing films. DirecTV would get them a month before their theatrical debut and offer them as pay-per-view films. Then A24 would handle them as theatrical movies, and they would just sort of go about their normal shelf life. The deal initially started out with Denis Villeneuve's Enemy in early 2014 and continued on for until 2019. I believe the last one that I saw in my research was Skin and the Hole in the Ground in the summer of 2019.
It feels like a lot of people don't understand A24's distribution model sort of in America, and especially when it comes to almost selling abroad, or they're unaware of so many of their films that usually make it to DirecTV. I'm sure, like yourself, we all kind of talk about the Lady Birds, the Moonlights, you know, some of these big movies names, but there's so many, like you mentioned there, Skin, Hole in the Ground, even something like Denis Villeneuve's Enemy, that a lot of people aren't aware are A24 films as well. Do you find that yourself?
Yeah, no, I think that's dead on. And part of it is a branding thing, not to get too in the technical weeds, but DirecTV isn't as sexy of a brand as, like, Netflix, which has its own, like, Netflix and chill, like that's in the popular lexicon. No one talks about DirecTV, so it's easier for these films to get lost in the shuffle. They're not marketed as much. That's just what pay-per-view movies usually don't get as much promotion. They definitely don't get tapped into the zeitgeist as much. And sometimes that feels like a tragedy, because Enemy or Slow West got as much acclaim as a traditional A24 film. And sometimes it does feel like Backstabbing for Beginners or something, where it's a little bit more like a direct-to-video movie that has the A24 logo on it. But overall, yeah, there's definitely a little bit more confusion on, like, oh, these are A24 titles, versus, like, we all know what Uncut Gems belongs to.
How do A24 and DirecTV decide what get placed on their channel? Because we've just hit over the 100 movie sort of mark with A24, and a lot of their early catalogue was either something that would maybe get dropped into the cinemas, for example, your Spring Breakers, your Bling Rings, and then you would have a range of movies that would get dropped onto DirecTV. Was it as simple as some of these films aren't as good as the others and they'll go to DirecTV, or was there sort of like a process for how it got kind of split up?
So this was a really interesting concept to contemplate, because I realized once I started thinking about it, I had no clue. I'd been aware of the deal for like 7 years and I had no clue. So I did a little bit of research. When they first announced it, there wasn't much clarification on like what's going to constitute a DirecTV film that A24 does. It wasn't like they said, dramas go to theaters, horror goes to DirecTV. They were just sort of, Enemy being the first one, seemed to indicate initially that the plan was to maybe do more avant-garde movies. Maybe we're aware that the movie with Jake Gyllenhaal and a giant spider is not going to be crossover hit, but, you know, it could have a life on video. So we'll do that. Afterwards, it gets a little fuzzy, especially in like 2015 onwards, where some of the titles are like Barely Lethal, Mojave, Equals, which are like titles that nobody knows about in any fashion. And it can't help but come off, and I want to be clear, I'm not saying that this is the procedure, but it can't help but come off as like, these are the lesser A24 films that got sort of burned off, you know, especially post-2015, which, again, isn't to say that that's the procedure or that all A24 DirecTV movies are bad, but it does feel intentional that, like, The Witch was supposed to go to DirecTV and then got bumped up to theatrical release. That alone feels like an indicator of this is how we're parsing out what goes where at A24.
Yeah, that was something you highlighted in your article, that it kind of could be fluid, that something like The Witch, which has become one of their most popular films, has almost kind of broken out into the zeitgeist, was destined for sort of this pay-per-view TV model and might not have been the film that many of us got to enjoy in cinemas. Was it always sort of quite a fluid model of like A24 last minute could say, actually, we think we've got a hit on our hands here, depending on maybe reaction at Sundance or maybe online reaction or critical reviews? Was that kind of how it potentially worked?
It seems like there was at least some fluidity to it, because The Witch went there, and even beyond the A24 DirecTV deal, other films in their catalog had like adjustments in their release plans. How to Talk to Girls at Parties is my go-to example of this, because it was from its Cannes 2017 premiere, it was apparent that that was going to be a big movie. And then when the more mixed responses came in, they sort of shuffled it off to a smaller theatrical release and a very quick pay-per-view release. So I think A24 has always had a very fluid, like, we're going to make this up on the spot. They don't do it a ton with the DirecTV stuff. Usually if you get announced that way, it's like, okay, that's what we're doing. But The Witch is an example alone of like, but it can change. And that's pretty important.
It's quite interesting, just as an aside almost, thinking where, you know, you talk about How to Talk to Girls at Parties. Certain films that kind of go under the radar in America, that was something that got like a cinema release here in the UK, obviously a different distributor here in the UK, but there's always seems to be quite interesting about what they think will do well in the UK. Something like Enemy got a decent cinema release here sort of on the indie circuit, you know, How to Talk to Girls at Parties, you know, various other ones that we've never heard of sort of in America have gone around the circuit here, and some films that have never touched the UK, for example, have actually ended up sort of being released in America.
I think that does go back to how A24's model is primarily as a distributor, not as someone. They've only just started producing heavily in-house stuff. How to Talk to Girls at Parties, like you said, it's interesting to remember that it's a production from British companies like Seesaw and Film 4, who would have a lot of investment in making sure that in its home country it gets seen. And that just makes things extra weird in the United States in terms of figuring out, okay, who's going where? Because it's not as predictable as like, oh, it's a Warner Brothers movie. that'll go to theaters. It's like, okay, maybe it'll go here, maybe it'll go there. Oh boy, just trying to figure that out.
You almost feel sorry sometimes for some of the distributors. For example, I think of like the Green Knight recently here that was put out originally going to be by Entertainment One, who got the rights to distribute in the UK. Then it got pulled, and then it got sold to sort of Amazon in quite a quick turnaround period. And everyone's sort of tweeting at A24, like, why are you not releasing this film? You know, what's going on here? And they're almost like, they have nothing to do with this, but almost the brand has got so strong that people look at the Green Knight and they don't think, oh, I'm going to go check out that new Entertainment One release. They think of like this American production distribution company as having the release kind of power across the world, when that's not the case. It's just within America.
No, that's a perfect way of putting it. Especially on that one where, again, it's like they don't produce all their movies. The Green Knight is a filmmaker they've worked with before, but they actually did not produce that film. That's the only one they secured the distribution rights for. So it's another weird thing of like, just makes it all, the distribution stuff, an even tanglier web sort of unfurl.
Kind of how much money potentially was sort of that DirecTV deal worth to A24? Would you say it was a benefit to them as they sort of approached their sort of first 10 years in the business?
So it's interesting that the initial announcement said that DirecTV would invest $40 million in the partnership. And Enemy initially apparently only cost about $2 to $3 million to acquire. So that's a lot of movies they could acquire. They were all in that span. They weren't clearly weren't going to do like Apple TV did with Coda this year, where they're spending $25 million to acquire one movie. They're going to space that out a little bit. So they didn't make any more mention of how much money they were making. A24 doesn't divulge regular finances. They are not a publicly traded company, so they don't have to like say how much they're making from what. $40 million is definitely $40 million, which I know sounds like a simple statement, but especially for a smaller company like that, that's definitely a lot of cash. And I'd imagine that was very helpful, especially in terms of getting them a little more financial footing in that very vulnerable first year where a lot of movie studios, especially independent ones, can struggle. And I think even more so than finances, what it did was establish that A24 was willing to collaborate with other people. It immediately said the new people on the block are not going to be off on the side on their own. They're willing to cooperate and be like, okay, we'll meet you halfway on something, which I do think helped lay the pavement for their modern stuff, where they've got Apple, and then they can work with Amazon, Netflix, they can work with anybody.
It's interesting when you think of $40 million, where in the grand scheme, perhaps not too much in the world of cinemas when we're just talking about, say, Spider-Man getting $1 billion, but you think of like $40 million, that's the budget of 40 Moonlights, for example, to make them. And that's, I suppose, that kind of seed money almost helps them move from distribution to almost being able to produce some of their own content too.
Part of why A24 has been able to be so stable is that they don't overspend. The Moonlight only cost $3 million to make as their first production. They've only recently started making movies that cost more than $10 million, and they're very smart in not, like, blowing the farm down. They're not going to spend the $100 million. They're just going to be like, okay, do this. And with that, you start to realize what you just said. That $40 million can go a long way if you go that route.
It's been sort of 2 years since the sort of last A24 DirecTV release, which I think you mentioned was Skin and The Hole in the Ground. Would you say sort of the Apple TV deal has sort of superseded that, or was it just sort of the end of the cycle of DirecTV?
So it's interesting to note that The Hole in the Ground came out the same month as Native Son, which debuted on HBO. And that's an A24 production, but they sold it to HBO. I think it's much worth mentioning that, because that signals that A24 was capable of moving beyond just DirecTV. By 2019, in the span of like 6 years, which isn't that much time, but even in that span, the world of like watching movies at home had changed dramatically. Netflix had started releasing had never released an original movie when the A24 DirecTV deal was announced. That's all changed. So there's a whole new world for them to inhabit, and I think it was clear that it was like, there's not only other things for us to do, but there's other arms of the AT&T Corporation, HBO and DirecTV, that we can go work with. So I do think that it was a sign of the times of like, this is an end of a chapter for us. They never officially announced that they were done with it, but it does feel like, okay, especially since it's a nice round 5 years after Enemy, like it feels like that's the end of the time, with the Apple TV Plus deal being like the next level of where they were going.
Yeah, I think I can't remember if it came out on HBO as well, but there was a film, I think it was called Share. I can't
Yeah.
remember if that was an HBO one. And then, as you mentioned, sort of Native Son, which I think is a criminally underrated movie. I mean, I found that one quite a tense and tough watch one to watch. But I suppose those movies almost set the scene for like A24 collaborating with HBO. We're sort of on the this episode drops the day after sort of Euphoria season two finally arrives. So I suppose there's almost that stepping stone into, working with someone like HBO, which also has that kind of reputation as a prestige brand, which A24 have clearly kind of tried to work on in these past few years.
Oh yeah, no, that's definitely part of it. It's like I said, even more than the money, they just want to get those like rubbing shoulders and establishing that they've got the good ins. So it's a lot of like, it's definitely the end of an era, and I think superseding is an interesting way to phrase that. I almost think a better way to put it is just that Apple TV Plus is the evolution. Like it's just, this is where we're going now. It's not just that we're gonna put stuff on pay-per-view. We're gonna really like commit to working with a big name streamer, and even on HBO stuff like Native Son and Cher didn't get massive promotion obviously, but working with HBO in any context, that's a big deal. So yeah, they definitely took the next step after that.
Sort of the Apple TV Plus deal, and I suppose I'm going to have to keep reminding myself to add that plus in there because Apple TV and Apple TV Plus, very different things. That sort of deal was announced to quite a lot of fanfare before the sort of streaming service even launched, but there's been very little information on the sort of the finances, how it works, and the commitment from both sides to this. Has your sort of research managed to uncover anything sort of new on this deal? Why does it feel so secretive, and do you have any insight into to the finances?
So the very secretive nature of their cooperation is reflective of how tight-lipped streamers are. We're just now getting like some viewership data from like Netflix, and even then it is big ol' asterisk. Like that's okay, sure, Netflix. I'm sure every new movie you put out is your most watched ever. I'm sure. So it's that's emblematic of why we're not getting a lot of information. And even doing a lot of in-depth research, I was surprised that there really isn't even like leaks or anything. It's partially because this stuff isn't as like, I love A24 stuff, but it's not as like rampant for clicks on the internet as like a Marvel thing or a Star Wars thing. So like people aren't gonna be like dying to get the info on like On the Rocks. How'd that financially break down? But the closest I can find is they did spend $12 million together to acquire Boys Days at Sundance 2020. And I also noted that there have been four movies so far, by my count, that Apple TV Plus and A24 worked on. Half of them are documentaries, which is a domain that A24 had dabbled in, like with Amy, but they really hadn't done a lot. You could probably count them on one hand. So the closest I could say is that the cooperation maybe is allowing A24 to explore new territory of storytelling in that regard, but there's still too little data. There's still too few movies to really say concretely. Could just be a coincidence. But that's all a long-winded way of saying it. There's not a lot of data to explain what's going on financially, but it doesn't seem emblematic of like, there's problems in the relationship. It's just like this is how streaming works now. Everything's behind closed doors at a big company.
One of those films, I know I completely forgot about it. There was it was The Elephant Queen, which is a very bizarre film in a way where people can almost discuss and debate where in terms of secretive is like, is it actually an A24 film? Like we did a review on it, but we didn't feel conclusively like, is this a film? Like it doesn't feature the A24 logo. It's some on some information, it's classed as an A24 film, some it's not. Some people will argue it's not. That film was very bizarre compared to the ones that followed in terms of say Boy State on the Rocks, Tragedy Macbeth, where it's those are clearly A24 films. They're pushing it. Whereas The Elephant Queen is like this really weird anomaly in their filmography.
A24 loves branding, and the fact that The Elephant Queen isn't like boosted on their social media like the other ones you said, definitely strange. I almost wonder if that's just something Apple had lying around that they wanted an extra bit of prestige for. Again, the tight-lipped nature of everything just makes it hard to parse.
I think we're approaching sort of like the third year of Apple TV Plus at the moment. So obviously we got Boy State, Elephant Queen, which we've got to give a shout out to, On the Rocks last year, and we've got sort of the upcoming Tragedy of Macbeth. Do you feel sort of Apple TV Plus are happy with what they're getting out of this deal in terms of output? It also looks like sort of the Souvenir Part 2 will be dropping on there because my co-host had a bit of a search on Apple TV and he found that it was coming straight to there, it seems. So would you say Apple TV Plus are happy with this rate of return? Like, a film a year, or do you think they would have been expecting a bit more?
There was a piece a couple months back where Variety wrote about how A24 had actually looked at selling itself. And one of the most interesting comments in it was, from an unnamed source, was that A24 had actually approached Apple to come on board for multiple movies in the last few years. And Apple had said no, which is shocking on a lot of levels, and I think reflects the fact that Apple has a really strict idea of what they want to do with narrative films right now. The minimal output they have right now is very star-focused. Tom Hanks has multiple movies, Tom Holland, Justin Timberlake, they want stuff with big-name actors. Now, A24 does stuff with big-name actors. Adam Sandler, Denzel, on Macbeth, obviously. But I think even Macbeth, there's a reason Macbeth is on there and not, like, Lamb or The Humans or something, where those are talented people, but they're not automatically like, oh, that's an A-list person. So I think that might be part of it, is the reason why there hasn't been as much is mostly, I do think, could be just as mundane as, oh, these don't quite fit our profile yet. They wouldn't mind doing artsier stuff. It's just like, but we need a big name to it to stand out. So I think that's probably why the lower rate of stuff in the library so far.
It's interesting as well when you think of like their TV output. I mean, I love For All Mankind, for example. A lot of their TV output is a lot more sort of like focused on sort of that auteur vision, you know, very little kind of named big stars. But yeah, you're right. When you search that Apple TV Plus homepage, you're seeing Tom Hanks, Tom Holland, the big stars, the Russo brothers. They've made the biggest movie of all time. There is almost that weird disconnect between sort of their TV and film division.
Oh yeah, and even like for next year, the next two A24 movies they have for them are not, they're not the small things. They're not tiny movies. They've got Sharper with Julianne Moore, and then they've got guys everywhere from Josephine Decker, which doesn't have quite as many big names, but still has Jason Segel and is based on a very popular book, which could almost count as the brand name itself. So it's interesting that, yeah, that does seem to be the mold for A24 Apple TV Plus stuff, and probably why we just haven't seen a ton of movies from them.
The content, as we've discussed, is quite thin on the ground when it comes to A24 films in their library. What exactly are sort of Apple getting out of this? Because there's almost that disconnect as well between sort of all the stories for years. I always think back, like, I grew up as a Stargate fan, and I remember at the time they were like, we want to bring Stargate onto us, like we want to bring their viewers onto iTunes at the time. And then you sort of, you think of like in the middle of the pandemic, they want to try and buy James Bond. I think like the number was 400 million they were quoted. They wanted to get a big movie and maybe the franchise on, because MGM was potentially up for sale and bringing that in, but that never came together and it went to Amazon. What are Apple getting out of this deal exactly, when it's almost like a film a year and it might be an Elephant Queen compared to, say, you know, something a bit more prestigious like The Tragedy of Macbeth?
Well, I think that's the word there. Prestige is the big thing. They signed on a deal in 2018, which is just 2 years after Moonlight won Best Picture. And there's definitely, I think Apple TV's big thing was simply just, we're the new kid in town. We would very much like to have someone that can produce, like, award season stuff. And that got upended because of COVID, obviously. But there's definitely, that's the biggest thing that Apple gets out of it, is automatically prestige. Because it's very odd how 25 months in, Apple has only just now started to hit the ground running with films, despite having the 400 million you just said for Bond. They have only just now seemed to realize, like, oh, we can produce things in-house instead of acquiring stuff, because a lot of their stuff has been acquisitions, it's been more broad genre fare, and stuff that I like Finch, but it's not usually like award season stuff. So they could have the money to do that, but it seems like they initially wanted just A24 to take over maybe be too strong of a word, but produce attempts at getting that kind of prestige. I think that's the biggest deal for it. And for A24, like, and the deal, they get a little more financial security. They get a little like, okay, we can work with a big name streamer. They never divulged an official budget for The Tragedy of Macbeth. And I want to make clear that this is speculation, but Deadline Hollywood, when they talked about the Independent Spirit Awards, mentioned that it couldn't compete because it cost over $35 million to make. And that automatically made me go, oh, that's why it's an Apple TV thing. Because that's a lot of money. They want to make sure that's spent properly. So if it's anywhere in that ballpark, it becomes clear why H24 likes this deal too. Because they can play a little bit more. They can get a little more experimental and on a bigger canvas.
I'm stunned by that number. That's the first time I've heard about it being 35 million, because I think their previous highest was perhaps something like Macbeth or Uncut Gems, which were sort of like 15 million and 20 million. And, you know, no offense to Macbeth, which I have seen, that doesn't it's a beautiful looking film, but I'm don't know where the money potentially has gone at that kind of high a budget, unless it's gone on to the talent, I guess.
It might just be Denzel and Francis, honestly. It literally might just be that, and then like COVID protocols. I don't know. Maybe Ralph Ineson takes a large chunk of the budget. Yeah, who
Yes.
knows?
So Macbeth feels like sort of A24's best chance at sort of a potential Academy Award nomination this year. A24, it's often felt like, despite some award success at the Oscars, doesn't commit financially to playing the game. But will Apple Money perhaps help with the push and might become a potential sort of quid pro quo in the future with this deal that A24 might perhaps be think about going, you know what? We were going to put this prestige sort of more picture into the cinemas, but actually, maybe we'll do it through the Apple deal so that we can sort of have their might behind us when it comes to the season, for example.
It's interesting to think about like what this deal means for the future, because when it was originally done, it was basically just like, hey, maybe you'll produce like one or two things a year for us, and one of them can be the next Moonlight, and Apple gets Oscars, A24 gets finances. We're in January 2022, and we're trying to figure out, like, we're all around the world trying to figure out what is working in movie theaters, because it's clear older audiences aren't coming back, which is the bedrock of a lot of these A24 movies. And like, I think the deal becomes a lot more, at the very least, it becomes a lot more integral now, because it's like, maybe this is a way for us to get Macbeth out there. Macbeth, I think prior to the pandemic, probably did seem like oh, this could be a big hit. And now I actually understand why A24 might be like, oh, this, if West Side Story can't make it, is our Shakespeare movie in black and white gonna really, masses going? So it could provide an alternative stream for that kind of stuff. And A24 has clearly made it apparent they're not abandoning theatrical, because who else would give Lamb a release over 500 theaters in North America? Like, good God. But as like a companion, yeah, it probably could be. It could be a good agreement for A24 on Apple's end. I think they love the idea of being in the award season. I mean, good God, I mean, who doesn't among the studios? So it does work out nicely for both of them on paper, and especially in the more fractured landscape of what theatrical cinema is going to look like in the future. I would love to live in a world where the tragedy of Macbeth can play in as many theaters as possible, but I also, you got to sort of face reality at times. That doesn't mean, again, that doesn't mean abandoning theaters. It's just more like being open to, like, okay, there could be alternatives for certain titles. The relationship could become especially important in that case.
We spoke about it actually, like with Lamb, when we reviewed it, where it still blows my mind that that film came out the same weekend as Titane. You know, this movie that was riding huge critical acclaim, viral marketing, and A24's Lamb. You know, this small meditative movie on sort of what it's like to be a mother with a lamb in it, and that trumped that movie as well. So, that blew my mind. But as we speak just now, there's the indie cinema just a couple miles away from me. They're screening The Tragedy of Macbeth for a good couple of weeks, before sort of the Apple deal kicks in. But I do find it interesting where On the Rocks was one of the sort of first films last year here in the UK that was released into cinemas as things reopen again. But almost on the like Apple don't release their sort of the money they make in cinemas, which makes it really hard to tell which is how it's a success, where it feels like something I don't understand how they can do that.
If I'm being honest, I don't either. I promise I'm not gonna go on a soapbox or anything for an hour. But it does feel like a weird thing that does kind of bother me about the streamers, where they want to play the rebel that's shaking up the film industry, but they also want to inhabit the traditional stuff. They want to go to Cannes, they want to go to the Oscars, they want to go into theaters, but they don't want to play by the rules. And not even like restrictive rules that stifle art. They just don't want to like play by what everyone else is already doing. Like, here's how much money our movie's making. We can accept if like a movie flops. We'll just be open about it. Like when Paramount was very open of like, you know what, Mother didn't work, but we took a chance and we're okay with that. Like, we need to take that sometimes. The Netflix and Amazon and a Apple don't do that, and it does bug me. It feels like a big like that is just. I hate to sound sick because it sounds simplistic, but it just doesn't seem very fair. Like, all the other studios have to like put up with the headlines of, this movie's not doing well, but you guys don't? It seems weird. I don't know. It just feels very odd that like they want to inhabit those same spaces, but they don't want to play by the rules that everyone else is doing.
And the metric that they've decided to go to, which I just find hysterical, is people watched 500 million minutes of Red Notice in December. It's like, what does that even mean, and so on? And I know that they count, like, someone that will watch 2 minutes of an episode or a movie, that counts as a viewer, which just I find absolutely the weirdest metric possible. And you're right, they want to be these outsiders, but they're like fudging the numbers. If they were, like, you could imagine someone like out of Enron using a metric like that.
No, yeah, that's a good way of putting it. It's, they want to fudge with everything and make everything a hit. But to paraphrase The Incredibles, when everyone's special, nobody is, and it makes it difficult to figure out what's going on. And I remember, I think it was David Elrich at IndieWire, when the pandemic began, made a good point that box office numbers aren't just helpful in terms of, like, finance stuff, but they're also helpful in, like, what's resonating with the public? Like, it can help you tap into, like, the zeitgeist of, like, okay, romantic comedies are up, but maybe neo-noirs are down. What does that say about us right now? And that could be really interesting to look at, like, what Netflix movies are even doing well right now. Maybe comedies are really popular or something. So it feels like a missed opportunity on so many levels, and also a frustrating one. I feel so bad for A24, Neon, and all the other people that are trying to put stuff out there right now and being bold, and then, you know, the streamers aren't really helping with that or anything. They're playing a different game, but I don't know if this makes sense, but the streamers are playing a different game inherently, but they want to act like they're playing the same game as everyone else. And it's like, okay, that's sort of weird.
Talking of streaming services, we aren't even done with DirecTV and Apple TV. There was an even a new one that came up this year. So the Fantastic Saint Maud, which was due to come to cinemas in the States, but the pandemic ended that, eventually ended up on something called Epix. I think you've kind of already answered this, but why did it go there compared to, say, Apple TV Plus? And I noticed something a bit odd recently, because I was a huge fan of Saint Maud. I caught it a couple of years ago at the London Film Festival. I caught it when in cinemas in the UK last year, but it only was available to buy on iTunes from like a couple of weeks ago as well. So it feels like the Epix deal almost had, like, gave them an exclusive window before it could go elsewhere. Can you shed a little bit of light on Epix and why this film was an outlier on this service that I have never even heard of?
Oh, no one's heard of Epix. Okay, so Epix, in like a sense, is owned by MGM. It used to be owned by Paramount Lionsgate too, but they dipped out. It's like a premium cable channel. It's supposed to be like HBO, but it's just not very popular. They just don't have a lot of stuff to offer. And I think part of how they've been trying to combat that is through a handful of exclusive premieres, and Saint Maud is one of them. Saint Maud very abruptly just announced, I think just a few weeks before it aired in late January, that it was going to Epix. And I presume it didn't go to Apple TV because it's not star-studded enough. Now, I also adore Saint Maud, but it definitely doesn't have big-name actors in it. And Apple has not done very much horror, as far as I know. They did Servant with M. Night Shyamalan, but I don't think they've done any horror movies. So that also could mean, like, they were just sort of like, that's not for us. And I don't think Netflix would, they like any content, but I guess Epix just put up a lot of money and they decided, fine, we'll do that. There doesn't seem to be a lot of connections between the two companies otherwise. Epix doesn't license A24 movies, A24 doesn't make TV shows for Epix, so it's a very random deal, but it does show that A24 is willing to go anywhere so long as the movies can get out and find alternative ways to get them, especially during a pandemic. And I will say too, as just an aside, I remember being frustrated when Saint Maud got sent there. But a year later, I can't believe it's almost been a year, after seeing what the box office has been like, I do actually understand completely. Because again, if West Side Story and King Richard couldn't make it on the big screen, Saint Maud probably didn't have a prayer in the US at least. So
it seems interesting as well when you think about some of the films, like I think of Zola, for example. I mean, they maintained, we are not releasing that one to a streaming service. That one is coming out hell or high water into cinema screens. And I suppose they had much more involvement in that film to say Saint Maud, which was this small British movie that they put down the cash on when it came out in sort of Toronto. But then they've also made successes of, say, The Green Knight, for example. They held off, and it ended up being, like, I think it was second in sort of the American box office, and it made its money back within that first week in terms of its budget, which was fantastic. It feels like they're very picky and choosy, where something like Saint Maud, you can imagine with such a low budget in terms of their investment in it, might have just been only a couple hundred thousand or something like that to buy it, I'm not sure. But like you could almost think, well, even if we get that into a few cinemas or drive-in screenings, which became kind of really popular, and I think Neon took advantage of, it felt very odd that that was the journey for that movie.
No, I think you're dead on in terms of like that just came down to like they didn't have as much involvement in it. Because initially, I remember pre-pandemic, they were pushing Saint Maud. They had the trailer on Uncut Gems. They actually gave it a fun Easter weekend release date. I remember they even did some cute posters of like your savior is coming, which I was like, oh, that's fun. I like in again in normal times that probably would have actually been like a cool, hey, quick counter programming in, you know, April, you know, we'll spend a little money on it. But yeah, probably just once the chips were down and things were going, I think they mentioned too that they were releasing it for Oscar consideration because the window had expanded to February. That seems a little weird to me because the Oscars don't recognize horror a lot, and especially not like newbie horror films from lesser known talent, even if it's really good. So that struck me as a little weird, but I guess that could also have been an influence. It was like, we want to get this out at least for consideration, so we need to get this going.
As much as we're fans of it, I think the only one I could maybe imagine in an Oscars world where it would have been given an award was maybe like sound design or something like that. But even then, I think it would have been up in a hard one up even to get in there, I think.
Oh, no, definitely. It's a pity, and this is a whole other topic, but it does sort of go back to like how I sometimes wish these movies could exist outside of award season stuff. So that's not the only definition of it, but yeah, it's what the company thought was going on, so.
Yeah, it's interesting with the film as well. I think you mentioned counter-programming. If I remember, like this takes me so back to almost the beginning of the pandemic. I think it was originally going to be the counter-programming movie against James Bond in America, if I remember correctly.
It was, which would have been awesome. Two, like, British films coming out of the U.S. and, like, just one a little different from the other. Would have been fun, honestly. Like, it even mimicked, like, how A24 put It Comes at Night against The Mummy, and they put The Witch opening one week after Deadpool. Like, it's kind of cool, actually, how they usually go up against the Goliaths and try to, like, throw their rock at them. But, again, it just didn't pan out, obviously.
Another deal that we've seen come around in the past few months is with sort of Showtime. So they've done some stuff previously with Showtime. I think of Moonbase 8, for example, which found a home there. But with Showtime, they sort of had this pay TV deal for sort of theatrical releases. And that was with The Humans, which we reviewed recently. And we're hoping to have the director on soon. How did it end up on sort of this Showtime pay TV one as opposed to perhaps a small rollout or again sort of Apple TV? Because this one had, you know, quite a huge sort of starry cast in a way.
When I was watching The Humans, I honestly did think a few times throughout of like, this would be so good. I watched it at home. Like, this would be so good in a theater. And I also thought like, oh man, this would have probably struggled theatrically. I think in normal times, it's so sad because I sound like a broken record, but it's like in normal pre-COVID times, it probably would have. Like, it just, like, they put Krisha in theaters. Like, it would have probably been fine. But I was thinking, like, the bold filmmaking choices, like the emphasis on wide shots, the minimal spaces. I imagine, like, they just went, this is going to be difficult to sell to the general public. It's not even a sequel to something that went into a theater already, like The Souvenir. It's just going to be very difficult to do, so I imagine they just decided, okay, Showtime, we'll work with you on this. And also, again, this is speculation, I want to be clear, but in last year I noticed that for the first time the streamers started taking advantage of how if a movie doesn't get Oscar recognition they release, they can submit it to the Emmys. Amazon did Sylvie's Love like that. I remember distinctly they campaigned it for Oscars, and then when it didn't get anything they just went, okay, TV movie. I wonder if that also played a little bit of a part. Honestly, I'd like maybe they just went, you know, this could be, this is kind of a small fish in a big pond at Oscar season. But man, we could be like the kings of the TV movies at the Emmys. So maybe that's even part of the ploy. Like, this could really play well with that group. Like, that's total speculation on my part, but I do think there's a lot of reasons why they went, okay, Showtime's probably better for this one right now.
That's something that'll be fascinating for us to sort of chart as we kind of go through their movies in the future. But could you imagine in the future, sort of, we hear it so much with streaming services these days, whether it's Paramount Plus, Disney, for example, of trying to cancel a lot of their deals and bring them all under one house and roof? Or can you just sort of imagine A24 is just going to kind of keep juggling between all these different partners?
I'd imagine they're going to keep with their partners, like the various people, mostly because A24's branding is mostly like, is a little different from like Disney's branding. I don't imagine there'd be much incentive to bring like everyone home, like all the Marvel stuff, for instance, where it's like, oh, but now Spider-Man can do this or whatever. Like, I don't know, like if you'd want like an Uncut Gems Ex Machina crossover, sure, but like there's not, I don't think there'd be much value in bringing everyone home. Plus, in this case, these deals are like, don't require them to relinquish ownership. They still got home video rights to all the Apple TV stuff, which is a very unique thing in the world of streaming films. Like, Netflix doesn't put their stuff on DVD, but A24 clearly can put On the Rocks, and I will bet you anything, Tragedy Macbeth will too. So that, I think, also makes it extra incentivized. It's not even just like, we'll sell all our stuff to other studios. It's like, we are lending it. You know, like, we still have ownership of it, and if you still have ownership, why not spread the wealth around? It makes things a little extra competitive. You get to work with different people. It's, and plus, it's different options for different films. Some movies might benefit better from being on Amazon versus HBO. It just allows for more options.
A24's international distribution of quite a few of their films can almost come be much slower than sort of America. I think of something recently like First Cow, or almost non-existent for some titles. Do you have sort of much insight into how they sell their titles internationally?
So when I saw this question, it actually inspired me to do some research. And it's really interesting how international distribution reflects how they've grown as a studio. So initially, as we mentioned, A24 only dabbled in acquiring movies, usually finished films from film festivals. So that meant a lot of the movies they were buying up already had distribution deals in place overseas. Spring Breakers was handled by Icon in Australia, Vertigo in the UK, Ex Machina was handled by Universal in most international territories, because Focus Features was supposed to handle that here. And they sold it, and I'm sure they don't regret that at all. But when they started making their own films, they continued the process initially of selling titles to international distributors. Moonlight got spread across a bunch of companies throughout 2017. Some in-house titles were actually handled primarily to one distributor. Sony handled 8th Grade. Universal handled Waves internationally. It's still very erratic, but some of their in-house movies are now just getting sold to like one person overseas to handle. And the erratic nature of that can make like the streaming debut of something like Uncut Gems, which is Netflix everywhere but in North America, that can be disappointing because you're not seeing it on the big screen. But I can imagine it could be helpful to a degree, only because it's like, I know where it is. I don't have to worry about like the erratic Green Knight thing we were talking about earlier, of like, is it coming? Who's handling it? It's at least like, I know where it is at all times. Like, I can just go on there. So it's, the international thing for them is just nutso, and definitely reflective of just, they're not a big Warner Brothers Universal company. They do have to rely on a lot more people.
On sort of the flip side, you think something like when they sold Uncut Gems to Netflix, it was a big screening still at sort of the London Film Festival. It was something that did get a dual cinema release and onto Netflix, kind of, you know, and that's something Amazon also did with The Green Knight recently in the UK, for example, where we got it in cinemas, we got it on streaming, pick your choice and so on. Are you a bit surprised in a way that they've not kind of sold more perhaps to sort of Netflix internationally? Someone that can go, right, we'll take care of it and the rest of the world, you don't worry about America, you've got that sorted, we'll take care of the rest. Are you surprised that they've sort of still stuck with quite a lot of the traditional people where it's like Universal, Sony, Focus, Curzon, you know, you name it, it's been a broad range?
It's, yeah, I'm not too shocked, but only because the streamers have kind of gone the opposite way of A24 and recent years, where they want ownership of worldwide. Like, Netflix, when they were starting out on their original film stuff, were actually very open on, like, we're happy to take Annihilation everywhere but North America, and did with Uncut Gems. And in just, like, a span of, like, 2 years, it's hard for me to imagine them doing that again, where they, like, it's not impossible. Like, I believe the third SpongeBob movie had that kind of release pattern. But, like, it's, they very much want the global rights to these things, which I think can make it difficult now, where especially as stuff like HBO Max is starting to move internationally, even the newer streamers want that like global distribution model. So I'm not shocked they haven't done a ton more like Uncut Gems, because I imagine if they could, they would. Like, that would definitely, it worked out well for them financially. I'm sure they would love to repeat that model. It's just that as A24 continues to be more open to working with so many different people, the streamers have moved to a bit more insular, like, I'm working for me and I'd like to just get worldwide stuff.
On sort of the other side of it, we've seen sort of A24 still stick to sort of the traditional model, which almost feels crazy to say these days, of releasing films on DVD, Blu-ray. We've seen things like The Green Knight has been released on sort of 4K in America. I think their deal is through sort of Lionsgate. And obviously, I think we've seen On the Rocks from Apple TV is coming to physical media. Do you sort of foresee A24 sticking with sort of Lionsgate to continue sort of the distribution of their kind of home videos, as it were, and so on? And, you know, almost just going, well, that could be somewhat something that we could take on in-house, but we'd incur quite a cost, whereas we can maybe farm it out and know that we'll maybe make our money in the cinemas or digital purchases, for example.
Well, they've been with Lionsgate for 8 years now. No, it'll be 9 years this year, because it's 2022 somehow. And, I mean, when you're with them for almost a decade, it feels like anything can happen in Hollywood, but I would be shocked if they decided to shift off. It's clearly working out for both of them to a degree. Neon partnered up with Bleecker Street to make a new home video company called Decal that they put their stuff out. Maybe A24 would do something like that. I don't know. But, like, I don't think at the moment, I don't see them doing that just because they've been stuck with Lionsgate and working with them for so long. I just would imagine that's going to keep on trucking for the foreseeable future.
I think one thing that anyone listening to this can take away is that despite all their growth over the past decade, it still feels like A24 very much stay within their means, working alongside people that are larger or established names to sort of help get their movies out there. Just sort of keeping that sort of startup mentality and attitude seem to have helped them and not put them as a potential loss maker like, say, Annapurna was, that seems to have kind of struggled very much in the past few years.
I remember there was this long-form essay by VeggieTales creator Phil Vischer where he mentioned that one of the biggest pieces of business advice he got was that the middle ground is where a lot of companies fail. Just because you're not Tim Software Hut anymore doesn't mean you're Microsoft automatically. And I think A24 has navigated that very well, especially compared to other studios. And when you look at them a lot, like STX, the original form of DreamWorks from the 90s, they always start out with like, we're doing 9 divisions, and we're going to just automatically be Disney, right? And H24 has been more gradual. They've actually gone in the opposite direction of, like, we're just acquiring things. Now we're going to produce things in-house. Now we're going to do some television. They're very slow and taking it gradually. And I think that combined with their ability to work so well with other people and being even a bit ahead of the curve in retrospect in terms of recognizing, like, the DirecTV deal, like, okay, people can watch stuff at home and they'll want to see this stuff, has really helped them stay alive compared to the STXs that feel like they're always on the brink of collapse. H24 has definitely felt like they're a lot more conscious of how to keep things moving and also like who to work with.
I think it's interesting as well. I know we've come back to it a few times, but something like Lamb, for example, I can imagine they didn't spend the greatest amount of money to acquire the rights to that. And yet simple things like going back to the tradition of, we're going to market something. We're going to make a really nifty trailer that maybe will get people's attention, maybe get people talking online and get them to see something, you know, perhaps over, say, Titane, for example. You know, I'm not sure who's releasing it sort of stateside, but it's another one of these big movies, you know, a lot of praise coming out of festivals and Cannes, etc. Can you sort of see that, like, they just, as you say, keep it simple there, where going, we could spend a lot of money on advertising, on this, promotional materials, playing the game, but maybe if we make a really good trailer like we've done all the way back to The Witch and Spring Breakers, maybe we'll get people to see this funny little movie that we've just spent a bit of money on.
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely the mentality they're going with. Like, there's, I think they're expanding a little bit too in terms of like, they're expanding more to television and they're doing more stuff. But I do think just the core root of like, don't overspend and don't be afraid to make something a little distinctive. Because like, who else was going to put a ghost story in 300 theaters? You know, who else? I couldn't believe Climax played at my local Cinemark in suburban Texas. A Gaspar Noé movie in Texas. Okay, good for you guys. Like, that's amazing, honestly. So, like, they keep taking bold risks, and I like that they managed to balance that out with, like, some savviness of, like, but we're not going to spend $100 million promoting Climax because that's just not going to help anybody. Just throwing money down a hole. So I think balancing those two elements will definitely keep them going for the next decade or so.
And I think that budgeting kind of pays off big time as well. I mean, there's been so much discussion about, say, Spider-Man making all this huge money and then it just blows The Matrix, West Side Story, a lot of these other bigger movies out of the way. But perhaps if you just have that smaller movie, that counter-programming movie, and if you do get a quarter of a people turning up to watch it in a cinema, or someone making a double feature in New York or Los Angeles or Austin, for example, that they'll get a money back on it and return. It's just giving people that option and not having to worry about being, you know, bowled over by Marvel, Fox, or Disney, for example.
The film landscape right now is definitely divided into those two halves, right? The haves and have-nots. It was true like just beforehand, but it's only getting exacerbated. That's due to a whole slew of stuff, mainly consolidation in the American film industry. Again, another subject, another time. But A24, I definitely think, has found a nice way to not only create indie stuff in there, but occasionally stuff that breaks through and even gets the kind of box office that like mid-budget films would back in the day, like Hereditary or Uncut Gems and Lady Bird, where they're actually making like real money. Like, that's good coin right there. So it's exciting to see that kind of success happen with stuff that's unorthodox, and to be reminded of like, hey, people do want this stuff. They just might not even realize they wanted it. I don't think anyone knew that we wanted something like The Last Black Man in San Francisco before it showed up, but it's beautiful. It's wonderful. Like, you've just got to put it out there. And the budget, like the more you like just restrictive budgets in terms of marketing, help make that less of a risk and allow these things to exist on the big screen where they belong.
I suppose this is a big question, but where do you sort of see A24 going in the next decade on this sort of streaming front? Is this something we're just going to continue to sort of see, or is it one of these things? I think we now have the established names, the Disney Pluses, the HBO Maxes, and et cetera, et cetera, that they're just going to sort of take it on a film-by-film basis and sort of go along with that front? Or do you maybe see something a bit more revolutionary happening?
Right now, I think their big thing is that they're just going to try to work with a bunch of different people. They're not afraid to let things get distributed by other outlets. It's interesting to note that this same year that A24 had Apple TV Plus and their first thing with Epix, they also had their first movies distributed by Hulu and Amazon with False Positive and Val. Interestingly, again, Val is another documentary, which shows that maybe streaming is like a good home for that. Anyway, I think they're going to continue working with those streamers. I won't say like that they'll have, you know, oh, they'll have 80 movies in 10 years for Hulu, but they'll probably still collaborate with them. I can't imagine it's a one-off. They'll probably do some more stuff working around. I just think it's going to be a matter of like, where does this movie fit and where does it go? Because again, we're in such a fractured landscape right now. We need to take chances still on stuff like Lamb and The Souvenir Part 2, which I'm so glad got a theatrical release in the US. And come on. But it's also being cognizant of like, maybe certain stuff is going to just work better, especially on a budgetary level. So I think the next decade is just going to be very uncertain, especially right now. But I do think the deals they've established and the relationships they've set up right now are going to continue. I don't see a reason why they wouldn't not only continue them, but maybe even expand on them. So in a nutshell, H24 is definitely going to continue being like just everywhere you look in terms of streaming services.
We've spoken a lot about A24's work, but it's now your turn. Where can people kind of read or check out your work if they've really enjoyed listening to you today? Where would you kind of find your work? And is there anything you'd recommend our listeners to check out? Because I know you also wrote a great piece about sort of come on as well, with quite a unique angle.
Okay, well, that's very kind of you to say. People can read my movie reviews on thespool.net. But you can also check out my features column on Collider and Looper. And I've written there recently on Collider, I'm really proud of, like my piece on Encanto as an autism allegory. Come on. Over on Looper, I've written about like the big box office takeaways of 2021. And exploring like why certain musical films didn't perform well financially in the past. So those are just a handful of things I'm really proud of right now. I've also got some pieces on Scarlet Teen and Fangoria. So like A24, I try to work a little bit of everywhere. I try to just go wherever I can. So, those are just the main places you can check me out.
And is there places online that you'd recommend people to follow you, to stay up to date with anything that you're posting or kind of reviewing?
I occasionally post on Twitter under just the handle Douglas Lane. I'm not too fancy on that. And I'm a Doug Film Fan on Instagram. That's where I am most active on social media. So if you want to know what movies I'm seeing through some ticket stub pictures or anything, or I'm writing, please do feel free to check me out over there.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been an absolute pleasure. As soon as I read your article, I just knew this was something we'd have to deep dive into. And I'm already dreaming that I think we're going to have you back on to talk about A24 and the box office, because I feel that's a whole other subject that I think we'd really love to hear from you as well about.
Oh my gosh, Lee, it was a pleasure and an honor. Seriously, this just was the perfect way off a new year. Thank you so much for having me on. The podcast is terrific. I was listening to episodes all weekend. Just, y'all are doing a great job over here. Just thank you so much for letting me be part of the fun. It was a real privilege.